Welcome to the Health Flow Podcast. I'm your host, Jean Armand. Join me weekly as I share health information that will educate and inspire you. Please consider supporting this podcast by listening, subscribing, sharing, and rating. Once again, welcome to the Health Flow Podcast. Welcome to episode number 40 of the Health Flow Podcast. I'm so happy to have my guest, Dr. Ali Zentner. Dr. Zentner is, she received her undergraduate medical degree from McMaster University and completed her internal medicine residency with an extra year in cardiology training at the University of Calgary. She is a diplomat of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. From 2015 until 2019, she was the medical director of the Vancouver Island Bariatric Program, and she built the program into a multidisciplinary bariatric program. Dr. Zentner is the author of The Weight Loss Prescription and the medical advisor to Global, National, and CBC. With a wealth of clinical and practical experience, Dr. Zentner built the Revolution Medical Clinic and serves as its medical director. I'm so honored to have her here. She is also the founder and director of the Canadian Obesity Peer Support Program, which is an online and in-person peer support educational platform for clinicians wanting to learn about obesity. Most importantly, in addition, she's also the founder and director of the Obesity Project, which is a multi-level educational program that addresses weight bias in medicine. Welcome to the Healthful Podcast, Dr. Zentner.
Oh, thank you. Call me Allie, please.
Okay, Allie. Thank you so much. I'm so excited that we found each other.
Absolutely.
On my podcast, it has all been about education, you know, just giving the audience, my listeners, not only educating them about healthcare, but also motivating them to want to take better care of themselves. Yeah. And I've previously done an episode on obesity, so I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so share, tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got to the obesity journey.
I am a Canadian physician, one of those, oh my goodnesses. I've been in practice now for 20 years, and I actually started my practice initially in internal medicine and cardiology, and looked at sort of risk stratification, meaning my idea was that if we could address how people sort of got to disease, whether it was heart disease in that case, and try to avert those events from happening. So try to intervene sooner. And whether it was, you know, taking care of people with diabetes and trying to, you know, intervene earlier and get them healthier sooner, as opposed to in many areas of medicine, unfortunately, we're sort of we intervene much later in a disease process where the disease has taken hold, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And what I was really seeing was this idea that, you know, obesity was playing a significant role. And I know there's massive controversy both about the concept of the word obesity and controversy about the fact that obesity is very much a disease, and that's probably something that we'll talk about. But I realized that, you know, we were telling patients for example, if a person was diagnosed with diabetes, we were providing them with information about what that meant and what treatment options were available to them, and providing them with sort of a whole treatment plan about what we would do in the healthcare field and what the patient could do in their everyday lives. And that we did that for every disease. We did it for heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and cholesterol. But when it came to obesity, we just said to a patient, and this sounds very crude, but we just said to a patient, you know, you're fat, it's your fault, and you're on it. You got yourself into this, you get yourself out of it.
Right.
And that was morally wrong. It, first of all, it was scientifically wrong, because the science shows that, you know, body regulation of energy and how we carry extra weight and how a patient, whether they are born with obesity or how they develop obesity, is so multifaceted and so much beyond a simple math equation of eat less, move more, that not only was it scientifically wrong, but morally it was, you know, this violation of the principles of medicine, which says that every person gets care, period. I mean, here we are in the middle of a pandemic, and you don't, you know, I was on call for a COVID ward. You don't say to a patient, well, how'd you get COVID? Let's discuss that. You know, we don't do that in medicine. It doesn't matter. And every person gets care regardless. You know, the time for finger pointing in that respect, it has no place in, yeah, in my profession, in our profession, yours, yeah, and mine. And so I realized that, you know, the scientist in me loved the complexity of body energy regulation and the science behind obesity. B, the sort of socio-cultural dynamics around talking with patients and listening to them, even more importantly, about what their goals were and what their aspirations were for their own health, was huge and such a draw. And then finally, the sort of social justice warrior in me loved the fact that this was a population of people who were marginalized for far too long and who needed a voice and deserved a treatment, and that this spoke to the idea that, you know, health is a right and not a privilege. And so that, you know, 20 years later, here I am.
That has evolved. So I noticed that you also had your personal weight loss journey. You want to say anything about that?
You know, it's funny, I will say, it may come as a shock to many of my patients, because I don't really, you know, when I'm in clinic, I'm a physician. And as you know, as a healthcare provider, a healthcare visit is not about you, as doctors, we are unfortunately stereotypically very self-centered. My apologies on behalf of my practice, or my profession rather. But I think that, you know, when I speak with patients, I make the visit very much about them and their experience. Mm-hmm. Is it a surprise? You know, I'd love to say that I came to obesity medicine purely because as a doctor, I was fascinated in it, but mm-hmm. I'd be lying, because at the time that I started pursuing obesity medicine, I weighed about 170 pounds more than I do now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess the sort of cliche is that I was my first patient. Okay. You know, and I found that learning about the physiology or body chemistry and the genetics and the environmental factors behind why one person gains weight, and can't lose it, and why another person doesn't gain weight at all and can eat whatever they want, you know, and everything in between, that it was fascinating to me as someone who had carried extra weight my entire life. Like, I remember even, you know, since age 3 or 4 being that kid on the schoolyard. And so, yeah, from a science perspective, it was fascinating to learn kind of the biology behind that. But even more importantly, I think that it did two things. One, it allowed me to sort of find a space for my own treatment, but also to understand that treatment was varied, that what works for me or what was treatment for me was not treatment for everyone else, which is a massive step to take as a clinician, because you literally have to take yourself out of the equation and it has to be all about someone else's experience. And so that was one piece. And then I think finally it ensured, or it was sort of a guarantee of empathy, meaning although I would argue weight bias exists in my patients as much as it exists in my peers. So, you know, remember we were on the schoolyard, we were either bullied, we were the bully, or we were the kid standing in the corner thinking, you know, whoever it was, that we weren't in that fight. So we're exposed to weight bias on all ends of the spectrum. And we often, as a result, are sort of educated, if you will, air quotes, in it, about its positives, you know, about its negatives at every step. So I think that, yeah, there was this beautiful kind of identification for me, but also an automatic empathy. When I first started practicing obesity medicine among patients that I had, I think it allowed me a bit of street cred among them. You know, I was fascinated to see when patients would come to my office and meet me, they were almost relieved that I was carrying extra weight as I was losing weight, because it implied that, oh my God, she's one of us and she's not gonna, like, you know, there almost needs to be, you know, a sign up in every office of every clinic that does sort of obesity medicine, relax, you know, this person's not gonna be mean kind of thing. And so I found that fascinating, that there was this automatic kind of insurance policy that this was going to be a positive experience, which,
just, you know, looked like them a little.
Sure, which is interesting. And again, speaks to the idea that this is a disease that you can't hide because you literally wear it. You know, mental health is a fascinating one. I always say that we are in obesity medicine now where we were in mental health and depression in about the 1970s before. Yeah. And even then, we have miles to go with mental health acceptance. But we've come a significantly long way. And that's a disease that a person, for example, with depression can sort of hide. Whereas, you know, a man or a woman with obesity, it's out there. And
yeah, you see, it's what you see. So how did you lose the weight?
It was a combination of factors. I mean, you know, I think this, we're going back now 20 years. So I've been pretty much at a stable weight now for the last 5-6 years. I did it through a combination of lifestyle modification and medication. I think this, you know, it's important to understand when we talk about weight loss.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, I think there's like a few kind of things to almost get out of the way. So when we say disease, like when we talk about obesity as a disease, we don't mean that a person's sick. And I think that's a huge kind of first point that needs to be nailed home. And you know, a disease means that the body doesn't do what it's physiologically supposed to do. That disease can come from typically genetic predispositions, meaning environmental factors. And then what happens is what we call a physiological mismatch. So, you know, for example, in diabetes, there's genetic predispositions where the body doesn't regulate blood glucose the way it's supposed to. And as a result, it affects how you move through the world, whether it affects morbidity or sort of your quality of life, or it affects your mortality, which is how long you live. And the same can be said for obesity. So body energy regulation is hardwired. It is a function of 37 different hormones in the body. You know, our brain and our fat tissue and our gut talk to each other 24/7. And, you know, if you want to explain obesity at a cocktail party, it's that the brain actually thinks it's starving, even though it's not, and it inappropriately stores fat tissue. And so that's, you know, And if you think about it, if we're talking about 5,000 genes that are involved or have been linked to energy regulation, if we're talking about 37 different hormones at play when it comes to the physiology or the hormonal regulation of energy, and we're talking about an environment that we as human beings were never built for. Like, we are polar bears living in deserts. Like, we are a species that evolved over thousands of years to endure famine and harsh conditions, and the world doesn't look like that at all. So it is such a complicated system that to tell someone to just eat less and move more and just go on a diet, whether it's keto or Atkins or Weight Watchers or what, pick one, like they have the latest paleo, and to tell them to do that in a world where they're exposed to 600 food cues a day. That's the average human. That was before COVID. It's probably like 800 now, you know? But to tell them to do that is just bad science. Like, it's like telling a person with depression to just cheer up, or asking someone with Parkinson's to hold still.
Right.
So I think that, you know, and it's hugely controversial. I'm aware of that because I am constantly defending this at cocktail parties. With, you know, my beloved husband is always like, okay, here we go. Let's this one. We're never being invited back here again. Okay. You know, but I think that the issue here is that it's really complicated. And if you think about it, when we talk about obesity, the disease, we're probably talking about like 50 different diseases under one single umbrella.
Right.
But what we've done as a society is we've mashed it into one small experience. We've jammed it into the dieting world, and we've left it to mainstream dieting society to treat.
Okay.
And I'm not suggesting that health can't be shared by everyone. Like, I appreciate every voice at the table. I mean, in my clinic, I have three nurses and a dietitian, three physicians. We have a team approach. I think there are, you know, many voices at the table here. I mean, I'm Canadian. We're very much about, you know, the whole sharing circle experience. So, but by the same token, I think this idea of, you know, you just need to push the plate away and go for a walk, and that's going to solve your problem, mm-hmm. is it's pedestrian and it's cruel, and it is oversimplification of a very complicated experience. So, you know, the understanding here is that about 8% of people respond to pure lifestyle modification when it comes to any disease, like even hypertension or heart disease or what have you. And I don't know, I think to say that you can diet away a disease is a very much an oversimplification of a very complicated body physiology.
So how does your program work? Like, if I came to your practice, my goal is to lose 20 pounds. I'm already, pretty active, but, you know, I'm in my 50s and it's just like, I think it's hormonal.
Yes, you're right. It's 37 different hormones, right? Yeah. So when you say hormonal, you're absolutely right. And like, for your listeners, hormonal means, remember, when we say hormones, we think estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, right? Those are the three hormones we think of.
Right.
Always. In fact, I don't know if we think of it even in in that order. We probably think testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, depending on who we are, right?
Yeah.
But a hormone really is, pure and simple, is a hormone is secreted by one organ in order to talk to another. That's it. If we want to think about it sort of from a conceptual perspective, a hormone is really your body's form of Wi-Fi, right? And there are 37 different hormones that regulate body energy. Meaning whether you're going to store something or whether you're going to use it or for later. And so, for example, fat tissue has 8 different hormones that it secretes, almost like a gas gauge on your car. Mm-hmm. We discovered this probably 15 years ago when leptin, which is a fat storage hormone, many people have heard of it. Yeah. It was finally discovered, and we realized, holy crap, we might be on to something here. Mm-hmm. You know, the brain itself has a center within the brain called the hypothalamus, which is kind of like your hormonal satellite dish that mm-hmm. sends out signals and receives signals to the body, hunger signals, fullness signals, craving signals, etc. So to answer your question, if you came to my practice, I would treat you like any other patient. So first of all, I treat patients with obesity. If I have someone who's got 5 or 10 extra pounds to lose, that's not a patient that I typically see. You know, we talk about being a multidisciplinary obesity clinic, not a dieting experience.
Right.
So we would, you know, first of all, we would take a full history. We would talk about, we would, you know, listen more than we spoke. So one of the first things that happens in our clinic is when a patient sits in front of me is they've already filled out an entire questionnaire about their history of weight gain or weight loss, their medical history of what, let's say, complications they may have associated with excess weight. We look at things like their quality of life. So we do what are called personal health, PHQ-9 or personal health questionnaires that evaluate sort of quality of life. We also screen them for depression and ADD and binge eating disorder, because we know that there are percentages of crossovers from the mental health perspective. So we do very much a holistic view of their entire healthcare experience. Mm-hmm. And then we sit down with them and I explain to them, my patients laugh because I have this little speech that I talk to them about it. And the first thing I say to them is, you know, we know that obesity is as much a disease as depression or asthma or Parkinson's, and telling people who carry extra weight to simply eat less and move more is like telling someone with asthma to take some deep breaths.
Right.
And I must tell you that I've delivered that sort of speech probably this year alone, maybe 1,000 times, and I watch people just exhale from relief. Like, and I think that, like, I can't think that I'm not onto something with that. That there's just that compassion is therapeutic, and it costs people nothing to be kind. And I am sure that on your blog you get, or on your podcast rather, you get the haters are going to hate, and the internet is a fabulous place for that, because anonymity breeds, can I swear, assholiness? Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, it's just, you know, it's fascinating how if you don't have to put your name on it, you can just be a douchebag.
Yeah.
And yet I think now more than ever, it just costs nothing to be kind. And I work in a socialized healthcare system where healthcare costs nothing. So yay. Right. But I think that, so then what happens to that point is, the patient and I all have a conversation about, you know, a bit about what their goals are and what their, you know, we talk about, we use a form of communication you and I talked about before we started recording called motivational communication, which is very much a patient partnership that gets a sense from them about where they're coming from, what their sort of health goals are. And then we try and reshape that conversation, because often people come to us with a specific number. And the problem with that is that health is a process. It's not a destination. Like, once you lose X amount of pounds, or once your blood pressure gets to a certain point, or once your blood sugars get under control, even once you cure your breast cancer, you still have to stay there. And so that in itself is a process. So I think it's fascinating where we almost have this kind of infectious disease approach to disease, where you know, especially when it comes to dieting, where you take the treatment, lose the weight, and then you're done. Like, it's just like a urinary tract infection, or, you know, you take the antibiotics, mm-hmm. and the bacteria dies and you're good to go. Like, and that, for the most part, as you're well aware, when it comes to chronic disease, which is really what medicine is these days, like nowadays, medicine isn't about curing, it's about managing. And more than ever, I would argue as clinicians, our job is to teach patients how to be patients, because patients like your listeners have access to information more than ever before. I'm sure they've learned more from your podcast than they have from their family doctors or from their nurse practitioners. Mm-hmm. So they have access to information. So we take the approach at our clinic, Revolution Medical Clinic, and it's funny, the name is called Revolution. One of my nurses named it because she always joked and said, you know, Allie, you're always talking about let's start a revolution in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so it just like a natural kind of name to call the clinic, but this idea that, and it shouldn't be revolutionary, but the idea that we should partner with patients and that the experience should be very much individual. And so to answer your question about what it'd be like is that you would actually determine what your treatment was going to be based on the principle that I'm an expert in your disease, but you're an expert in your life.
Right.
And so we partner together and we figure out what's going to work. Mm-hmm. And we don't map it out months or years in it. You know, we do what we do in medicine, which is we roll with every visit and we adjust and we accommodate and we be compassionate and empathetic, but we also be flexible. But mm-hmm. most importantly, and this is something that we're really adamant about at the clinic, we rely on science. So we make sure that we keep up to date on the scientific. So if, for example, a patient says to me, I want to try this diet. And I first of all, we say to them, okay, let's look at the science behind this. Like, because I think it's important to educate people about the fact that much of the quote dieting world that they're looking to doesn't have the kind of science that even Tylenol has, you know, or, you know, and just, you know, the they say phenomenon. So just because they say it's good for you, or they say that you should eat this, or they say 7 almonds or whatever, just because they say it doesn't mean that there's science behind it. And, right. you know, and I would say this, I think, look, there's a lot of, you know, I joke that COVID has been the most amazing educator for me as a clinician. Over the last 2 months, not just in teaching me about this virus and its capacity. And it's funny because I started my career in infectious diseases many years ago and wanted to be an ID doctor and then shifted gears. But I think what COVID has, I'm hoping, taught the world is science is key.
Like, it's important.
It's the laws of the universe. It's not what you believe, it's what you know. And it has the capacity to heal, but it also has the capacity to hurt. Yeah. And so I think that we need to respect it we're engaging in that therapeutic relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. So then choices, if I came to lose weight,
yes.
A particular diet of my choice? Do you do?
So we do nutrition. We talk nutrition. Now, we don't advocate one specific diet for a patient because we're not of the belief that there is one way to eat for everybody. Okay. I'm a huge fan that food is personal. Right. And I mean, you know, I'll give you an example. Every listener right now can think of the famous dinner party question. What would your last supper be? Right? Like, you already have something that you would have, and I have something, or what's your fondest food memory? Right? And look, you're smiling because your listeners can't see, we're talking on Zoom, and you're smiling because you already have it in your head, right? Or I say birthday cake in a crowded room talking to colleagues, and inevitably, you know, so food is so personal. Mm-hmm. And again, what we try and do is teach people about nutrition a bit. So most patients don't understand what we call macronutrients. So they don't understand the value of, like, what is protein and how many grams of protein should I be eating in a day? And what are carbohydrates? And, you know, what is low carb? And what does that number mean? And so we teach people not to count calories, but if they want to, and again, if they want to, we talk with them about counting macronutrients, because we feel that there's more value in that. One, it's less of a sort of dieting prison that they've been put in the past. It really empowers them to look at the foods they're eating and look at some of the nutritional value associated with food, but it also allows them a flexibility of fun. So, you know, where, and we try very hard, and this is one thing North Americans that are unfortunately very good at, is North Americans are fabulous at demonizing food. Do you notice, like, bad food in France is a stale croissant, whereas here we have a list of like bad foods and good foods. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've, you know, we've demonized food very much so. And so we try and break it down more towards the macros. We also offer patients, you know, a pharmacotherapeutic approach, meaning there are medications that are absolutely available to them. And there are, in fact, there's more medications in the United States than there are in Canada. They're approved for the treatment of obesity.
Can you name some of them?
So there are a class of drugs, for example, called GLP-1 analogs, which are based on a hormone. So when you and I, when all of us eat, you may have heard the expression, it takes 20 minutes for your stomach to tell your brain you're full.
Mm-hmm.
You heard that? So yeah. Food, so here's how I want you to think. Do you want a 10-second physiology lesson?
Sure.
So how we regulate energy in the body is based on two principles. Think about it. 50,000 years ago, we are all sitting in caves and we're starving. We have one of two options if we don't want to die. We can either store energy or we can hunt for food. And so in your brain, you have a storer and a hunter that are at work all the time. And they operate almost like a yin-yang, all a push-pull experience all the time. And the storer and the hunter communicate with the rest of the body based on how much food you're taking in, how much energy you have in terms of fat tissue or in your glucose stores in your liver or your muscle. And those two are at play all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are classes of medication, for example, that are based on fullness hormones that are secreted by our small intestine when we eat that signal the brain that a meal's arrived.
Yes.
And this class of medication is basically almost like a hormonal trick. So what one of the drugs, for example, you give to people, and it's a fullness hormone, so that it tricks the brain into thinking it's eating all the time.
Gotcha.
Well, it's impossible to think you're starving if you're getting a dinner bell signal, right? So that's one way. There's another class of medications that boosts fullness neurons activity within the brain, but also helps with the craving center. So it affects the storer and the hunter in the brain. In the States, there's another class of medications that's actually two drugs together that does the same things. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, for the sake, like, I don't know that I want to sort of list the medications. Also, you know, I think that if patients are interested in learning more about different classes of medications available to them, that's a conversation they should have with their healthcare provider.
Right.
But I think to understand that there are treatments out there that actually look at the physiology of this disease and then try and compensate for what the body's not doing. And that's the principle of treatment, absolutely.
Right.
And then there's the option of bariatric surgery, which I think many people think bariatric surgery is just making the stomach smaller or making the body not absorb nutrients. And it's the most wrong or biggest misconception about bariatric surgery, because bariatric surgery is a truly hormonal surgery. And what it does is it, remember that if your brain thinks it's starving because it's not getting the right input from your gut or from your fat tissue, if you can't operate on the brain, you can't operate on fat tissue, but if you operate on the gut, you alter the hormonal signal. So if hormones are your Wi-Fi system, bariatric surgery is like knocking out a couple of cell phone towers so that the Wi-Fi communication is better, so to speak.
So do you, I guess it all depends what I've seen. It depends on how much you need to lose also.
Right. And you bring up a good point, like need to lose. Like, what is that number? Like, and that is fascinating to know. So when we talk about that number is called the body mass index, which I call the bullshit medical index because exactly that. So do you know, you're a healthcare provider. Do you know where the BMI comes from?
Not necessarily. No.
So in the 1700s. Late 1700s, 1780, I believe it was, there was a Flemish astrologer. Now, this was at the time of like, right, just wait, you're going to be pissed off in a few minutes. But there was a Flemish astrologer, and this was at a time in science where we were looking at sort of social averages. This is where the bell curve came from and means and Pascal's theory and all of that. And we were looking at social sciences, and that's where social sciences came from. So they looked at, they wanted to be able to calculate a person's mass on the planet. Okay. And they looked at the Flemish army, which is a bunch of white men in the 1700s, and they came up with small, medium, and large, which is the body mass index for, quote, normal, let's put big air quotes on the normal weight, overweight, and obese. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in 1957, the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company in the United States of America adopted the body mass index as its indicator for health. Now, you or I would not be able to apply for life insurance in 1957 with the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. So think about who applied for life insurance back then. It was white men, period. Mm-hmm. First of all, the BMI applies to white men. It was established based on white men, and it was put into practice for white men. Mm-hmm. So that's one. Then in the late 1960s, there was a physician called Ansel Keys, who is, don't get me started on Dr. Keys, but he was inappropriately labeled sort of the father of cholesterol. It's always dads, right? Like, you know, moms are never given enough credit. Ironically, today is Mother's Day that we're recording this, but he was considered the father of cholesterol. And he actually came up with a program called the Heart Health Hypothesis. And it was a broad international study rather. It looked at different countries, and he tried to make comparisons between nutritional consumption and cholesterol. And this is where the whole idea of low fat came from. The problem was Ansel Keys flubbed his data. So he discounted large populations that didn't obey the rule that he was looking for. And this is why what we think we know about fat and consumption of fat and cholesterol is so jack wrong, right? Yeah. This is why we just because it says low fat is not necessarily healthy, right? And this is where the whole low fat, low carb camps formed. And we literally have realized that cholesterol, you know, serum cholesterol is about 80% genetic. Mm-hmm. It has very little to do with fat consumption, absolutely. Whereas conversely, blood glucose levels have very much to do with blood sugar or sugar consumption. And so anyways, long story short, you have an index that was established in the 1700s for white men that was adopted in the 50s in the United States for white men, and that was bastardized through the healthcare profession and integrated into our healthcare system in a very unscientific way, and is now used to determine like everything from kidney transplant criteria to whether or not a woman can have artificial insemination because her BMI is too high.
Yes, yes.
And that is infuriating because you and I both know, like as a woman, I am built differently, but my BMI might be considered high versus a man. And yet we know, for example, it doesn't make sense. Like we know, for example, women have to carry 20% excess fat tissue. They have to have 20% fat in excess in order to have fertility. Like we have to have meat on us.
We do.
So it's interesting you say that. So when a patient comes in and says, I want to weigh X by Y, we have a whole conversation about that actually takes away from the numbers and talks more about the health. And I'm more surprised at the fact that for most of my patients, mm-hmm. it's less about the numbers for them. And it's definitely more about they want to be healthy. Yeah. And they have no idea what that is. Yeah. And so you'd be surprised at how much, and maybe I'm being naive, but I think for many patients, it becomes less and less about a number. And if we insist that it's less and less about a number from a healthcare profession, then not only do we find such a positivity in terms of treatment effect, mm-hmm. because we're not treating a number. We're not treating a thing on the scale. We're treating a person.
Yeah. So
I think that's kind of the different angle, perhaps.
What, you know, this just triggered, what's your feeling about weighing yourself?
So I joke that most people, like, you need a license to drive a car, but mm-hmm. you don't need a license to operate a scale. And I would argue for some people, a scale is like a mood ring. You know, they step on it and they decide, oh my God, is the mood, you know, those mood rings from when, now I'm dating myself, right? I remember wearing a mood ring in the 70s and it was like black or red or blue or purple, right? So my patients, and it's fascinating because I've been doing telehealth medicine for the last 2 months, mm-hmm. and I have a practice. We have about 5,000 patients in our clinic, and I would say less than 10% have home scales.
Okay.
So I will tell you this, that I don't know that I am the common. I don't know that belief is necessarily shared among my peers. Mm-hmm. I think that a scale at home is not necessarily a great idea. I think unless you can step, you know, our patients, for example, particularly in my post-bariatric patient population, so people who've had surgery, mm-hmm. if they want a scale, they cannot weigh themselves more than once a week. And in fact, we recommend every 2 weeks because weight does fluctuate 100%. And the problem on the positive side, having a scale allows you to gauge just a numerical assessment. That's one. Yeah. And science is helpful and numbers are helpful in other areas of medicine. The disadvantage is that this area of medicine doesn't follow those rules as much because if your blood pressure is high and you check it at home and it's high, you don't think it's your fault and you're not feeling like you're less of a human being or you don't deserve love or you're not worthy just because your blood pressure is high. And for some reason, a scale doesn't have that same application, that there's an inappropriate power about it that I would say that I think it needs to be used responsibly in a personal life.
Yeah, I like that. I just the other day I was talking to a colleague and she said she read something that say, if you weigh yourself every day, that will motivate you to do the things that you, it doesn't because there are, for me, the weeks that I work out the most,
right. And
I get on the scale and I'm like, oh my God, I did so much workout. I was so good. And I've gained 2 pounds.
Right. And that's the sentence?
Yes.
Right. I did so much workout. I was so good. Like
good.
As if if you didn't work out, you'd be bad.
Exactly.
Like that's whacked, yeah. Right?
That's crazy.
Right. So two things with that. And as you know, so exercise sucks for weight loss. It doesn't work. We, you know, if there's one sentence we talk about, we should exercise to celebrate what our bodies can do, not to punish it for the food that we eat.
Right.
So exercise is wonderful for every other disease, but obesity. So there's that. You know, exercise is great for prevention of depression. It's great for blood sugar control. It's great for cardiovascular benefit. It is good to prevent weight gain, So we know that, and it's good at preserving muscle mass while you lose weight, but it's not a good vehicle specifically for weight loss. And there's volumes of studies to support that. And I can happily send you a dozen off just the top of my head. So there's that. But by the same token, you bring up a point that we see a lot in obesity medicine of this sort of bribing where Like, I'm not going to eat the dessert. You know, I went out for dinner with Cheryl. She ordered the pie. I didn't eat the pie. I'm going to step on the scale tomorrow. I better be down.
Right.
Because I didn't have the pie. Right. And then you step on the scale tomorrow. And for whatever reason, maybe you had a glass of wine and you're retaining fluid, or maybe it's that time of the month, or who knows, maybe it was a salty dinner. And there's just, and to your point, because you exercised more, your muscles are actually holding more liquid, because as we exercise, our muscles actually get swollen, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're, especially if you're doing weight training, you're gonna step on a scale and gain weight, you know? Right. You know, I'm a marathon runner. I joke that if I run marathons, I step on the scale right after a marathon, my weight's not gonna be down. It might actually be up because I'm swollen as hell.
Yeah.
But realistically, you bribe yourself. And
yeah,
bribing is not a motivator. I've been doing this a long time, and you mentioned you've been in medicine for years. Yeah. People are motivated by positivity. You know, it's a beautiful kind of discussion about what motivates a person. Mm-hmm. A person is motivated when they are not afraid, when they are informed, when they are powerful, when they are empowered, when they feel, you know, I talk about the four C's. So there is control, there is clarity, there is competence, and there is connection. And those are the four C's that work in everyone's life when it comes to their health, that work to motivate them. When a person feels like that, like clarity, like they understand the disease process, they understand their role in it, they have clarification about what treatment is going to look like, about what their role is, when they have control over decision-making process, over what this is going to look like, when they have competence in the people around them who are providing them with information and who are giving them care. And then the fourth C is when they have a connection. So it's that, you know, that famous saying is when you know the why, you can deal with any how, so to speak. And I would argue that if you wanted a fifth C, it would probably be either compassion or care. Like, I think that that's what motivates people, not stepping on a scale and feeling shit about yourself because you gained 2 pounds and yet you're working super hard and you kind of go, I don't get it. This makes no sense, because, you know, and part of the reason it makes no sense is that what the narrative that we have told people about what causes weight gain
is wrong.
And, you know, we have shamed and marginalized people let's be frank, weight bias is the last socially acceptable prejudice there is. You can tell fat jokes on TV still and no one bats an eyelash, and, you know, but
it's just
it's wrong.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the benefits of weight loss.
Great.
There's many.
So I would say, so, and this will shock people. So we know 5% body weight loss is all you need. Okay. So this is cool. So 5% is metabolic. So for example, we know that 5% body weight loss improves your blood sugars, your blood pressure, blood cholesterol, cardiovascular risk drops by 30%. A 5% body weight loss drops your risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 80%.
Wow.
That's whack. Like, that's insane. That's amazing. Right. Beyond that, 10% is mechanical. So we know that a 10% body weight loss improves your functionality, your mobility, your joints hurt less, etc. And everything, like any amount, so 5% and beyond, is mental. So meaning you have an improvement in your mental health, in your functionality, in your sense of self. We have, in fact, in our clinic, we're right now doing a study that shows that as much as 3% body weight loss correlates to a dramatic improvement in personal health scores. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out why that is. And we think that it's that just getting care makes people feel hopeful.
Yeah.
And so I think that might be part of it. So we know if we're going to quantify it, sort of the 5% and the 10%. But I think people think that getting to goal weight is the only way that they're going to be healthy. And so for some people, that's a far way away. And they think, what's the point? If I have to walk from, you know, from Washington State to New York City, it's not going to happen. No. Like, I'm not getting anywhere. But if I have to, you know, walk from, let's say, Manhattan to Brooklyn, see, I'm trying to be American for you, because I know if I give you Canadian landmarks, you're going to go, what? But
I do have family in Canada.
Yes, right. What's his name? His name's John, and he lives in Toronto. Yes, we know him. No, I'm joking.
No Johns, but I do have.
I'm totally teasing you, right? Because you know,
they live in Toronto. They do.
Right. Everyone says, you're Canadian. Do you know John? He lives in Toronto. I'm like, oh my God, John and I went to school together.
Oh.
Anyways, I think the idea, back to that idea, is that, you know, it doesn't have to be these massive amounts, and you know that. And I think even, because even I have patients who, for example, I do clinic on Saturdays, and I saw a lady yesterday, and she's 130 pounds lighter from when I met her.
Wow.
And she's like, well, I'd still like to lose 30 pounds. And I'm like, you realize that you are not celebrating the fact that you have lost 40% of your body weight, but you still have this destination in mind. And the danger, and so we talk about, what's the danger of having that number, is that you're missing it. Like, yeah. It's like you're driving, you know, when I was a kid, my parents, we lived in Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is right above North Dakota. Yeah, exactly. And so we used to drive every year. My parents thought this was how you took your, when you don't have any money, you put them in the back of an Oldsmobile and you take them somewhere. So we drove to Disneyland one year. I'll never forget it. And, you know, it was the classic sitting in the back seat going, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And I remember my dad getting out of the car and sort of vowing to leave us on the highway somewhere, and sort of turning to me and going, kid, you're missing it. Like, we've driven through the Black Hills. We saw the Grand Canyon. You're missing it. Like, there is so much here to be seen.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that happens with people where they think, if I can't lose 100 pounds, then what's the point?
Yeah.
And the idea is that they're missing it. Like, who knows what, you know, 5% of their body weight will do, or who knows what that mechanism of treatment will start in their lives. Who knows whether or not that's going to start them on a different healthy path where they're gonna feel empowered and they're gonna find their purpose as a patient and what that'll look like.
Yeah, you know, and then there's the danger of having unhealthy
right.
weight loss ideas, because
right.
then you can be anorexic, or, you know, just
or even that. you go on a diet, like these sort of fasts, right? So you go on a diet and you literally just treat the number.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that do when you're sort of dieting to a number where you're literally just torturing yourself physically and mentally just so you can step on a scale and see a number? Like, is that health? So I think that, you know, what needs to happen, if I were, you know, in my dream world, that we re-engage a different conversation around weight and around health that doesn't involve a mechanism that was developed in the 1700s for white men.
Right. And not only that, I don't know, I can't speak of Canada, but in the United States, I don't believe that our family practice doctors and internal medicine physicians are really well equipped or even comfortable with guiding and coaching a patient through weight loss. I don't think that in medicine, if we're saying it's a disease, yeah. obesity is a disease, then that should be a disease that you learn about yes. and we treat.
Yeah, and in fact, you're right. This is where Canadians and Americans are very similar. Mm-hmm. The studies show that medical schools in North America have on average, and in fact, there was one study actually just recently published showing the massive sort of imbalance of education that not just medical students, but residents receive when it comes to nutrition or weight regulation or energy balance or what have you, which is why kind of the Obesity Project came to light. Because the idea was, how can we expect our primary care physicians and our internists to educate patients when we're not even training the next generation of doctors? Like, forget it. And same, to be very frank, the same issue is there with nurses. So there's very little education in nursing schools across the board. There is a massive, and here's the challenge is that also in medicine, we train people to recognize patterns. We're sort of, you know this, like we train, you have this sort of SOAP method, right?
Yes.
Subjective, objective, right? Assessment and plan, right?
Yes.
So we have this sort of training that's ingrained in us to recognize patterns. Even I'll use the example of COVID, right? So if you have a fever and you have a cough and you have this and you have that, you present, here's the pattern, right?
Right.
Well, the problem in obesity medicine is that there's a number of patterns here, but the pattern narrative that we've told people they've gotten through media and through, you know, this sort of biased view that every person with obesity eats too much and doesn't exercise and is, you know, pick a word, is lazy, unmotivated, doesn't care, apathetic, etc. And that's the narrative that we're telling the world. And so those same people are our healthcare providers and our patients. And unfortunately, that's, well, first of all, it's wrong. And second of all, what it's done is it's demonized the patient, quite frankly, and it's marginalized the treatment experience. So, you know, I think that the first thing that needs to happen is just even a small amount of education. And what we've done in through the Obesity Project is we sort of engaged everyone across the board and said, hey, we're gonna for free. And in fact, if you have people who are listening to this podcast right now who are medical students or nursing students or they are educators and they want, we have a whole curriculum that we will, and the coolest thing is that class is in session on Zoom now. I mean, I'm teaching, you know, two different universities, one in Vancouver and one in a totally different province across the country. We have classes that we will teach your medical students or your residents. We have a whole list of curriculum you can choose from, and we will do it for free because we're happy to do so.
And how do they find out information about that?
So the website is nofatshame.com.
Okay.
As it sounds. And I think even my email is even on there. It's zentner@gmail.com.
And I'll make sure that I put that in the show notes too. Any final thoughts? Anything else you'd like to share?
No, this was lovely. You are quite magical. Thank you for having me. It's so fun. It's it's really neat.
It's all about education and exposure.
100%.
Yeah. And I want to know about different, you know, however way we can motivate by all the four C's that you said.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I think one thing I would say, Jean, is I think the biggest misconception is to think that people aren't motivated. I mean, everybody wants to be healthy. Show me a person who's not motivated to be healthy. You know, motivation's a weird word, but right?
I guess beyond motivation,
right.
Giving them what it takes.
They want the tools, right? It's not the why, it's the how. right? Exactly. And I think sometimes when we speak motivation, as you've beautifully said, motivation on your terms is the how. Like, how do I get there?
Yes.
Whereas sometimes we think, oh, it's the why. And I just, you know, I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, everybody wants to be healthy. Everyone wants to feel safe now more so than ever. And
exactly.
I think that my biggest message here is that, yeah, fine, haters are going to hate, but it really, it costs nothing to be kind.
Right. And when a patient come into you, you know, you have to develop trust.
Yeah.
And you'll go really far with someone who trust you versus feeling ashamed. What is he or she going to say about my weight this week? You know, it's
My father used to say, it's my favorite sentence. He used to say, if you lead a man through the desert, he'll drink sand at the end of it if you ask him to. And I mean, I don't mean it like I make my patients drink sand, but I think there's something very powerful, you know, where, and by the same token, trust is earned. Mm-hmm. And I hope that it, in particularly with my patients, that it's a relationship that's also respected because it means something.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I want to learn so much more about all the different
things. Stay in touch.
Yes, thank you.
Come visit.
I wish I could be with your patient just to lose 20 pounds.
Oh, good. You take care. Stay safe. Right. Thanks so
much.
Thank
you. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Health Flow Podcast. Your support is much appreciated. It is my goal to share health information that you find helpful. Email topics of interest to thehealthflow@gmail.com. Follow me on Instagram at TheHealthFlow, also on Facebook at TheHealthFlow. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share. Until next time, keep your health flowing.